Hey, this is Thomas Canal from PrimeLoop.com, and I listen to the Social Media Clarity Podcast.
When designing Pandemic, I barely playtested the heroic game. That's the most difficult level on the game. It was really hard. I wasn't sure I'd even be able to beat it, but I knew the internet could. And so we put it out there because I knew players would find a way. And again, you need to trust your players.
Welcome to the Social Media Clarity Podcast. 15 minutes of concentrated analysis and advice about social media in platform and product design.
Welcome to the Social Media Clarity Podcast. I'm Randy Farmer.
I'm Bryce Glass.
I'm Scott Moore.
And I'm Matt Leacock.
We have some gaming reputation news for you this episode. Microsoft recently announced that they would be notifying Xbox One players if they have been penalized for disruptive or abusive behavior through their reputation system. All Xbox One players have a reputation rating ranging from good to needs work to avoid me. Players will get notifications regarding changes to their reputation status, and if they slip into the avoid me category, may have difficulty finding others to play with in the Xbox One's matchmaking service, or may lose other privileges on the system. Conversely, Microsoft has hinted that they may reward players who maintain positive social reputations. And recently, game news and community site Polygon.com reported that a recent survey to Sony PlayStation 4 owners included questions about a player reputation system. Check the show notes at socialmediaclarity.net for links to articles with more information. As these systems develop, we may take a closer look at how they are performing and if they are meeting the needs of both company and community.
Today we've got two special guests. Bryce Glass returns to the podcast. You may recall that Bryce was one of our original hosts. Thanks for coming back to visit the old stomping grounds, Bryce.
Thanks. It's my pleasure. I'm really glad I could make it back.
He's returning to help us interview our special guest today, Matt Leacock. Matt, Bryce, and I worked closely together at Yahoo, where Matt was an interactive design architect for Yahoo's social platforms and products. Now he's chief designer at Sococo, a company creating technology to run virtual offices, where he heads all aspects of user experience, including interaction design, visual design, and corporate identity. He's also the owner of Locust Games, where he designs and develops board and card games for the international market. You may have heard of some of his award-winning games, Pandemic, Roll Through the Ages, and Forbidden Island. And he recently released Forbidden Desert. Pandemic and Roll Through the Ages were named Family Game of the Year in 2009 and 2010 by Games Magazine. Pandemic and Forbidden Island have both defeated the players on Geek & Sundry's tabletop web series. I've been lucky enough to be a playtester for almost all of these awesome games. Congratulations, and we are very excited to have you with us today, Matt.
Hey, thanks, Randy. Thanks for having me.
So, Matt, could you talk a little bit about what Sococo is and what it does?
Sococo is a virtual office for you and your team. As companies get larger and more distributed, you end up joining lots of teams where you can't get everybody in the same room all the time. We've created a very easy-to-use virtual office environment that allows you and your colleagues to get together on a virtual floor plan. You all get together and you can talk with voice, you can chat, you can screen share, you can use video. But more importantly, you can see everyone in your team on this floor plan all in the same room, or you can break off into different rooms. So it basically uses a visual metaphor to provide a sense of place for a distributed team.
I'd be interested in your take on how the two disciplines have informed each other, how you've grown as a designer, how that's been able to inform kind of your process when you put together a game versus your process when you think about product design.
Sure. Yeah, it's something I mull about quite a bit because I bounce between the two tasks daily, doing interaction user experience design by day and then doing a lot of board game design in the evenings and the weekends. I think one obvious thing is I've taken the toolkit of a user experience designer and I've applied it directly to board game design. When I started out early on, it's funny for me to think of a career in game design. I've wanted to do it since I was a kid. And, you know, when I started out at 8, I was kind of a hack. But, you know, you kind of flail and you're not really sure what you're doing and you try all sorts of different things and a lot of things don't work. But as I grew and became more experienced as an experience designer, I was able to apply that directly to game design. So I've got a lot more rigor and methodology around how I approach a design. I actually write up a creative brief. I really want to understand the audience. And I take a lot of the lessons from user experience research and apply them to playtesting. So it's really easy for me to think about how I've applied just methodology from experience design into game design.
I was really impressed during the development of Pandemic. I remember watching you user testing the documentation, the rules for the game, and I thought, oh, what a perfectly fantastic idea.
One of the most direct things that I think I get from game design that I apply back to user experience design and product design is just the directness and accessibility of playtesting. It's pretty easy for me to find somebody to sit down and try one of my games out, and it's really critical as well. I have no illusions that a game will ever work unless it's tested. It's kind of like code. If you've written it, it's guaranteed not to work. You have to test it, right? Same thing with interaction design, but too many times we pull some interaction design patterns off the shelf, we plug them in, and we say we're done, we wash our hands of it, we close the ticket, and assume that everything's going to be great. I have no such assumptions when it comes to board game design, and because I'm always playtesting board games, I get in that kind of rhythm and beat, and I bring a lot of that back into interaction design. It helps me bring that energy back and helps me remember that until I've got these things put in front of humans, it's not done. So that's one of the things that I really enjoy about game design is just how close you can get to players and how much you have to get inside their heads. And it's a good reminder for product design to keep that in the forefront of my process.
In 2008, you gave a tech talk at Google entitled Cooperation and Engagement, What Can Board Games Teach Us?, in which you drew some important lessons from the design of Pandemic to user interface and interaction design. It's been 6 years, both as a user interface and board game designer. What lessons still ring true from that talk?
I think all that stuff is still legitimate. I'd probably add a bit to it. I think one of the key things in that one was around flow and trying to keep your players in an engaged state between boredom and frustration, really. And that seems to be the key thing for me as a game designer. That's the key problem to solve for me. You know, to borrow from Jesse Schell, he had a wonderful book on the art of game design. He just frames games as problem solving in a playful mood. And in order to have enjoyable problems, you need to make sure they're not too frustrating and not too boring. And I think those things are directly applicable to product design, especially when you're talking about new user experience. You need to engage someone, you need to pique their interest, and get them into a channel where they can find the next bit of information. And it comes down to really good communication design as well, being able to talk about something generally and then get a little bit more specific. And down you go. They used to talk about this as the scent of information, always having the next breadcrumb in front of you that you can follow. That's a really, really key thing when you're talking about marketing and understanding how a product works and what your next steps are and how to really engage with the product. That was one of the lessons. Another one that was really key is, I think I use the word embodiment. That can mean a lot of different things, but things that come to me right away are, you know, really good use of metaphor and finding ways to create components, controls, to embody what you're trying to communicate so that things are self-evident, that you don't have to present a wall of text in order to understand how to either play the game or how to use the interface. So to use the Sococo example, you've got an avatar, and because it's a representation of a person, you expect you can do certain things with it. You expect that you can drag it around to move it. You expect you should be able to communicate with another person somehow just by directly manipulating the avatar object. A similar thing with a pawn. If you present a pawn to someone, it begs that it be moved with your hand. So just trying to find the right components that both communicate a story that is easy for people to understand and communicate the parameters of the system in which either that control or that component operate within. Another lesson was that of simplification and trying to make things as simple as possible, but no simpler. I told a story of in Pandemic how I was on a simplification kick and I kept removing elements just to see how simple I could make the thing and reduce it down to its fundamental core and make it incredibly obvious what to do. You know, super obvious because there were very few components, right? And I ended up simplifying a deck of cards down to the point where I realized that players were having a lot of problems with it. They were making all sorts of mistakes. They were mapping different actions improperly. And ended up having to add a little complexity back in and introducing as many as 54 new cards in order to overcome that. When I began, there was, I think, players had a mix of components, little cubes, and they had actions, and they could spend cubes or cards or just cubes or just cards, and it was just kind of a confusing mess. And I was able to whittle that down so that there was really only one thing that players needed to worry about on their turn, and that was how to spend four simple actions. And then did another exercise, and how could I communicate the four available actions as crisply and concisely as possible? And how could I provide a player aid in order to provide iconography and very direct statements so that people could understand what they could do in a turn very directly? A key part of design is throwing away everything that's extraneous or that gets in the way.
Sometimes simplification adds components.
Yeah, that's right. In that case, it was 54 cards, which is a non-trivial expense. When I did add that, though, it opened up all sorts of other doors for adding to the story, and it added a new clock mechanism and just unlocked all sorts of things. So yeah, it was simpler by adding components.
What lessons can we take from cooperative game design and apply them to social interfaces?
So one thing when you're designing a cooperative game is that you really need to trust your players. I see some people designing games and they put a helpful play tips in the end where they basically ruin the game and they explain how to win the game. I hear this from my daughter. Don't tell me how to do it, right? She wants to do it for herself. She wants to understand. And I think that's similar in a cooperative game. You're presenting a puzzle, and so to present the answer to the puzzle or tips on how to solve it is counterproductive. You need to trust your players that they're going to figure out how to play it. Actually, when designing Pandemic, I barely playtested the heroic game. That's the most difficult level on the game. It was really hard. I wasn't sure I'd even be able to beat it, but I knew the internet could. And so we put it out there. I did not test that a whole lot. I playtested the basic and normal levels quite a bit, but not the heroic level, because I knew players would find a way. And again, you need to trust your players. In designing Sococo, we needed to find ways to allow people to work together fluidly, flexibly, and we needed to trust them with degrees of freedom. So a basic user principle is just freedom, a locus of control. Basically, let the user do what they want to do. Don't put like endless supply of dialogues in front of them, warning them not to do a certain thing. If they want to erase their hard drive, at a certain point, you have to let them erase their hard drive. In a social space, this can be a little scary because you can have these interactions that can be questionable. But the thing is, you don't want to necessarily control that with software. No amount of software is going to prevent your colleague from being a dick, right? So basically, what we do with a lot of interaction in Sococo is just provide appropriate transparency to ensure that social norms take over, rather than trying to build in all these turn-taking mechanisms and checks and okays and this and that. So if you want to tear down what your boss is sharing in a large board meeting and show pictures of your kids, you can do that, but everybody's going to see it, and everybody's going to see that you did it, and so people don't do it. So we don't have passing control, for example, in Sococo. We trust that people in this controlled environment with people that they know are going to behave accordingly because we're providing the appropriate transparency. So if you want to kick someone out of your meeting when they're talking, you can do that, but it's going to tell you, and it's going to tell everybody else in the meeting, that you did it. And so, again, it comes back to trust. And it's an important lesson, I think, that spans both board game design and experience design.
Once again, I'd like to thank Matt and Bryce for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Randy. It's been fun.
Thanks, Randy. It was great to be here.
Our tip for you is to play Pandemic to get a feel for the elements of cooperative play, how simple elements can ramp up the difficulty from beginning to challenging play, and introduce new opportunities for play. If you are unable to obtain a copy of Pandemic or get to a local game night where someone can share a copy with you, the next best thing is to at least look at the rules, which are available for free online, and check out both a video introduction to the game and a video of a full game being played through. Links to Pandemic rules and play videos, as well as Matt's 2008 Google Tech Talk, are in our show notes. Hat tips to publisher Z-Man Games and Spida666 for the Pandemic rules and playthrough videos.
If you find our podcast valuable, please help others find us by subscribing to us on iTunes or Stitcher, liking us on Facebook, and sharing podcast links through your own social networks.
For links, transcripts, and more episodes, go to socialmediaclarity.net. Thanks for listening.